Del Mayo. Professor emeritus from North Carolina State University, native North Carolinian from big town of Messick, North Carolina. And I have been on this campus many, many times over the last three decades. So all of it's not new to me, but I am glad to be with this group because I think this is important. I think it's on a little bit different track than some of the other ones that I participated in. I guess I could divide this into two parts. I want to talk about opportunities in some respects that's taking place in terms of the South, the United States, and more localized areas. I then want to move into certain kinds of changes that are happening down at the local level. I guess one would expect on an occasion like this to begin with some perhaps material relating to values, the uniqueness, if there are any, in the Southeast compared with the rest of the nation. Well, I'll begin this way. Last summer, the former Chancellor Caldwell of North Carolina State invited me to the Research Triangle and invited a political scientist, a historian, and another sociologist from Chapel Hill to sit with him for a couple of hours at lunchtime and discuss this matter of values that might be unique specifically to the southern region and more specifically to North Carolina. This was really not a very productive 2 hours at lunchtime because we soon learned that we were not talking about uniqueness except perhaps in degree, but certainly not in differences. The universal's values are almost universal, and there are then alternatives and specialties relating to a particular group. So we start off with that as a background, and then I want to move now into what I think for the small church is some good news. In the 18 and 17 and, let me jump back a minute. In the past 160 years, for the first time, the decade of the 80s saw the non-metropolitan, small town, and village population grow more rapidly than was the case of the metropolitan America. It increased rather sharply. Nationwide, the metropolitan population increased by 9% in that decade, and the non-metropolitan by more than 15%. This was almost universal across the nation, community by community and certainly county by county. Not totally. There were some high points and some low points. So there are new people moving out. There are people leaving metropolitan areas and seeking whatever it is they seek in the smaller communities. Study after study in a half a dozen or so states during the last several years, where the statewide samples were taken, it became quite obvious that the preference, if it were possible, was for a small town, basically within an hour to an hour and a half drive of one of at least 50,000 population. At no point did they really talk about living in 6, 12, 15 million metropolitan area centers. So this, I think, is good news, and it's a good opportunity, makes possible an opportunity that we haven't had before, because in so many of our rural areas, the young people particularly were migrating out. And I'll come back to illustrate that point in a moment. The western part, northeastern part of the United States had an actual decline of 2% in metropolitan areas, that's that whole New England area. A decline of 2% in the metropolitan, but gained 12.5% in the non-metropolitan. The North Central gained only 1.6% in the metropolitan, but increased about 8% in the non-metropolitan. Then jumping all the way out to the West, the metropolitan, this is the, from Montana on out to Hawaii and Alaska. The metropolitan population increased 21%, whereas the non-metropolitan increased 32%. Now, the South followed the same pattern it's been following, except moving in the same direction. The non-metropolitan, that whole southern region, from Delaware all the way through to Texas, the metropolitan did increase 20%, but the non-metropolitan changed, but did increase, even though not as greatly, did increase by a little over 17%. Every state in the Union had an increase in non-metropolitan or rural small town population. Every state in the Union, with the single exception of Rhode Island, showed an increase in non-metropolitan population during that period. Basically, some studies that we've made indicate there are two sets of major factors. One is an economic factor relating specifically to jobs and job opportunities, particularly with certain kinds of industry moving into the Sun Belt regions. The other set of factors are a little more complicated, but are not economic in general. They are basically in terms of preference associated with kinship and neighbors, neighborness. So the movement back was considerable during that period of time. In fact, the net gain in non-metropolitan areas was something like 8 million people in the decade. Now, while this is going on, there is a considerable shift in the distribution of the population by regions. And I'll try to keep these straight. Let me use the South as an example. The smallest proportion that's in metro is in the South, with 63%. Therefore, 36.8% is now living in non-metropolitan areas. Interestingly enough, the next closest for non-metropolitan areas is the North Central. But there's some interesting things happening in that North Central that we can come back to in a little bit. Yes, sir?
Could you define some of these terms?
Such as?
Metropolitan.
Okay, metropolitan standard statistical, metropolitan statistical area, which means that there is a center of at least 50,000 population, 50,000 or over, and the surrounding population, including full counties, that have large commuting populations, and they set a percentage on that, and I don't recall what it is. For example, I don't know how many of you know the two examples I'll be using. For example, a rural county like Brunswick, down southeast North Carolina, next to Wilmington, is included in that statistical area or metropolitan area because it's so dependent upon Wilmington. Currituck County up in the northeast is a part of the Newport News standard metropolitan area. So it's basically a core of 50,000 and the surrounding population that's heavily dependent upon that core.
All right, yes. Surrounding counties don't necessarily have to be in direct contact with that city. It could be maybe, you know.
No, they have to be contiguous, except for the northeast.
All right, what do you mean by contiguous?
Well, joining each other.
They do.
That's the only one I know in North Carolina that way. In other words, they don't leapfrog.
Like if you took Atlanta, for example, mm-hmm. It would be Atlanta itself, the city, plus all surrounding counties that were in direct contact with
that Atlanta. Meet the criteria of so many commuters depending upon jobs.
Okay.
That's basically the two fundamental criteria.
All right. So you have metropolitan areas vice what?
Non-metropolitan areas.
That's it.
Right. Now I'll come back and confuse you a little more in a minute.
All right, great.
Okay, now, in the South, now I'm using the South as the fourth big area of the United States. now contains a third of the population of the country, 33.2%. We have only 29.1% of the metropolitan area's population, but 43.7% of all of the non-metropolitan area, all metropolitan population, is now in the southern region, which is a considerable. The point I want to make is new opportunities, new people moving in. Some are returnees, some are not. Also in this connection, want to bring up one other thing. The population of this country is a very dynamic one. And let me use two or three examples. Just because we're in place today doesn't mean we're in place tomorrow. Each year between today, which is, what, November 2nd, to next year on November 2nd, 20% of the population above 1 year of age will move from one house to another at least once. So if you take 20%, a fifth of 226 million people, you can get some notion of why some of us say that 100 years, 200 years from now, the U-Haul it and the moving van may be the most important artifacts that the archaeologists will be able to find to characterize this society that we live in. Okay, now, while that's going on, some of the littler counties are getting littler all the time. Some of them are more rural. For example, in 1980, the smallest county in the United States had only 92 people. And what kind of county do you have with 92 people, not just a rural community, but a whole county? On the other hand, there's one county in New Jersey classified as rural, non-metropolitan, has 344,000 people. I'm trying to get the point across. This is a very dynamic, moving, ever-shifting kind of population. But the way things have moved in this last decade, which was discovered about 1973, I think has an important bearing on some of the concerns relative to the small church. Not necessarily in more numbers, but perhaps new expertise, perhaps new leadership that may be available in your areas. We'll talk about how we find that out tomorrow morning and tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Now let me skip over to from non-metropolitan to metropolitan and talk about rural urban. That's just something you're more familiar with, I suspect. Urban is classified by the U.S. Census as any center, incorporated center, with 2,500 or more people. Rural, therefore, is anything 2,499 or less is rural, including all the open country. Okay, the 1980 census showed that we have 59 million people living in even that very restricted definition of rural. 59 million of them, or 26% of the population. But that's 26% of the total U.S. population. But if rural also includes the farm population. Now, the farm population makes up only 2.4% of the total population of the United States. It makes up only 9% of the rural population. Let me put the numbers of farm and rural in more perspective, particularly the farm. The farm population in this country reached a peak in 1935 with roughly 32 million people. It has steadily declined in the meantime. Now we have 5.5 million people living on farms. And that's probably down another 100,000 or so since these data. I want to make the point that increasingly rural and non-metropolitan includes a smaller and smaller proportion of farm population. Now in another generation, and maybe it's already true in some of the smaller churches in urban areas, that how you can use parts of the Old Testament becomes increasingly questionable unless you can define your terms even better than I tried to do for you. You say to walk down the city of Raleigh, down Hillsborough Street, and come in contact with a group of 12 to 14, 16-year-old kids, and start talking about beating swords into plowshares, and they won't have the slightest idea what you're talking about. Okay, I want to come back to that in just a little bit. Those of you from North Carolina might be interested that for a long time, North Carolina had the second largest farm population in the nation. That's long since gone. We do still have the second largest rural population. And you might be interested what the one state is that has a larger rural population than North Carolina. Anybody want to guess?
Somewhere around the Midwest.
No, you might think it would be Texas. Actually, it's Pennsylvania.
No.
has a few thousand more in the rural population. Now, we were talking about farm. This is where the change has been absolutely fantastic. North Carolina now has from a peak, well, let me start with farms. In 1935, we had a peak of 300,000, a little over 300,000 farms in North Carolina. Now there's about 80,000, maybe 85. In terms of the farm population, North Carolina, as compared with the top one or two in 1970, North Carolina is now the 10th. And here are the states, and watch the location of them, that now have a considerable larger farm population than North Carolina. Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kentucky, Minnesota, Missouri, Ohio, Texas, and Wisconsin. Okay, now there's some reasons for that. And I just want to stress one for a moment. See, mechanization hit this part of the country 10 to 20 years earlier than it did in North Carolina. So they were able to make their transitions gradually. Mechanization in agriculture didn't really hit North Carolina and become a reality. And you can pick your date. Whether it's 1945 or 1950, doesn't make any difference. Okay, then when the mechanization began to move into the major production units, then we moved more rapidly, all in a short period of time. Consequently, we have less than 200,000 people living on farms in North Carolina now. You might be interested, Alaska has the smallest farm population. They have all of 450. But Rhode Island has 1,937. But anyway. Now let me talk about, I've talked about farmers and farming a little bit. Let me talk about agriculture in the Southeast.
Question.
Yes, sir.
Back to your definitions of rural and urban, the 2,500 growth.
Now, right.
What is that restricted to geographically? Is that a city or town or area?
Incorporated area.
Area. So it's a geographical limit. What's that limit?
Whatever the town council wants to put in.
So it's a town instead of like a county?
It's not a county. Don't get too technical here because in Virginia, who said they were in Virginia here? Okay. In Virginia, the town is not a part of the county even though it's physically in it. Is that right?
If it's recognized, it's
state legislature. Right. This is not true here. If you go to the census and look at Virginia, and you want to know the total population in that unit called a county, you've got to add two figures together. Well, I guess you could characterize agriculture now and the way it's moving, fewer and larger. The point I want to make, though, is that the rural population, although it's increasing, that proportion that's farm is rapidly declining. I think this has a lot to say about the increasing heterogeneity of small towns and villages and string towns up and down the highways, of the heterogeneity in terms of the composition of a small church in those areas. As a matter of fact, occupationally, socially, economically, a church of 100 people may be just as heterogeneous as a city of, or a church of 1,000 people in downtown Raleigh. And it's this heterogeneity that all of us in this room are going to have to wrestle with, or are wrestling with right now. So no longer can farm and rural be thought of as the same thing. There is a movement, and I do want to counteract something here. You read many articles in the newspapers particularly about large corporations taking over American farms, large corporations being the way of agriculture in the future. That is increasingly true, but not the way the connotation is. Because there is most of these corporations, and in the future will be, families that for obvious reasons are incorporating. So the future of agriculture is still in the family-owned and operated business. But you get the scares every now and then about what's going on in terms of our productive lands and so on, that's being bought up by all sorts of people. Well, there is some of that. But all the prognostications that I've seen saying, yes, this will increase, but, and the but here is that these will be family corporations. The family corporation may, in fact, as the amount of that's exempt from inheritance tax has been constantly rising, maybe the only way that the land can in fact be transmitted from one generation to another. Now let me turn to two or three qualitative factors in terms of change and status and change. I want to use a couple of indexes of change in our educational attainment levels. There are some interesting things going on here. Let me begin with a generalized statement. The 1980 census showed for the first time in our history that more than half of the adult population, 25 years of age and over, had completed 4 or more years of high school. A significant gain. Now, I'm sure we're all interested in that fact. However, let me use certain states in the region, and I'll begin with North Carolina. North Carolina's figure was 55.3% of the adult population above 25 that completed 4 years or more of high school. Okay, in these data, the District of Columbia was counted in as if it were a state. So we've got 51 to work with. North Carolina was 47, Mississippi was 48, Arkansas was 49, South Carolina was 50, and Kentucky was 51. I bring this out because we are lagging still in terms of that category. On the other end of the continuum, the five highest states, highest in the sense of highest proportion, Alaska, Utah, Colorado, Wyoming, and Washington. And of course, Utah has been the leader for many years in this regard. We're also making considerable gains in terms of the proportion that have completed 4 or more years of college. Over 16% of the 25 and over for the nation as a whole have completed 4 or more years of college. That comparable figure in North Carolina is about 13.4, but I did not have all the states broken out. Moving from the indexes of education, let me move to a few indexes of per capita income. And I want to use a little arithmetic problem. In 1980, and I'm going to use the nation in North Carolina because we ranked about 40th, so there are 8 or 9 more states lower than this. And I want to talk about it in terms of dollars and cents. In 1981, North Carolina per capita income was $1,842 on the average, less than the national average. Okay, that's only $150 a month, translated on a monthly basis. Most of us have to get used to that, or are used to it already. Okay. North Carolina has, in round figures, 6 million people. Now, if you'll multiply that, what do you come out with on a monthly basis that $150 a month means? How much? No, it's 900 million. 900 million per month. So, you say, well, it costs a lot less to live in North Carolina, maybe, or in some of the southern states. But my air conditioning will about make up for some of the northeastern states' coal bill, or oil bill, or gas bill. But there's another way also. Even if the cost may be higher here and there, and it's not consistent with it, so the fact remains that we may be having to take it out on quality of services too. I don't know how much it would be. I haven't multiplied, but here in Wake County, the sales tax is 4 cents on every dollar. I haven't multiplied that out, but say half of it was subject to sales tax. I don't know how much that is. I haven't even tried to move. But if you put this on an annual basis, we're talking about $11 billion. Okay, there's some reasons for that, but I don't want to press the point. Now, while all this is going on, let's turn to some other changes that are triggered in terms of what I would call almost a revolution in the change in structure of our population. And let me use age just as an example. For the United States as a whole, the median age, that is half younger and half older, in 1980 was 30 years. It's only been a few decades ago that it was hovering around 20 or 21. Now, this is a real revolution in terms of the change in age structure of this population. And if you look at the national picture just for females, since their life expectancy is much greater, then 31.3 years was their actual, was the splitting point in terms of the median. Now, let me give you another index or two. And here we're talking about the U.S. itself. 65 and over, 13% of the total population. But there were as many people over 65, many females over 65, as there were under 10 years of age in the total population. I look back at some old notes that I had used about a decade ago, where I had said that the population above 65 was equivalent to all the population under 5 years of age. And now it's the equivalent for females to all the population under 10 years of age. Okay, carry this to an ultimate conclusion. We are faced with some monumental decisions, not only in the church, but some monumental decision of future redistribution of resources. Again, if you will let me use another kind of illustration, since I'm more used to using these crazy things than some of you maybe. I saw the other day, in fact I've got them in here, that for the first time that I've ever seen population data for the United States anywhere, in that decade of the 1970s, there were only 2 live births for every death in the state. That's the closest ratio I've ever seen. Let's carry that one step further. North Carolina gained about 4 million people. I'm sorry, about 800,000 people. But only half of that was natural increase in that decade, and the other half was, in fact, net in migration. So half of the increase was due to this very, very low fertility or birth rate. Well, we can go on and on and on. The point is that the age structure is changing. We don't yet have a good handle on the characteristics of the net in migrants, but those data will be coming very, very shortly. My guess is it will be fairly heavily weighted with older persons, but I'm sure it's not going to be totally, but I am sure it will continue to change this very dynamic population that we're talking about. Okay, now let me shift gears and talk in terms of an entirely set of, these are more structural changes which affect every major institution. And I hope you'll again feel free to raise questions or make comments. Now let me talk basically about the small community, the changes that I see that are going on across the region. First of all, I think that there is, and these are not in order of importance, I think there is a changing time, T-I-M-E, orientation, even in our very small communities. We look at a time orientation by your leadership structure or your community. They can look to something that might be a return to the past, a laissez-faire of keeping just where we are, or looking toward the future. Well, first of all, we can't go back to the past. That's totally impossible unless a nuclear bomb strikes us and then we're all gone anyway. And who wants to? A good friend of mine used to say that the good old days are really the result of poor memory. I don't want to go back. Well, I think we are then looking. I think our rural leaders, with increasing education advantage and multimedia advantages and so on, I think there is a real belief that we're moving ahead, planning for the future. Now, let me pinpoint one thing in terms of time or these other variables. There's no way in this world that you can build a small, strong, active rural church in a very poor, bad community. You can go only so far. And you fall back in the same trap. And I want to come back to that, because small communities and their institutions don't always move at the same rate, but they're usually moving in the same direction. Okay, time then. I think there is this future orientation. Second, I think there is strong evidence that the space, S-P-A-C-E, the space orientation is enlarging, drastically. We are becoming less and less localistic and more cosmopolitan, taking a broader and broader view of the world in which we live. Let's take the farmer down the road. The farmer can no longer be localistic. His markets may be in Russia or in Europe or for certain commodities in China, certainly in Japan. But the farmer also has to know something about production of soybeans in Brazil and China and so forth. And it's quite obvious in terms of that particular commodity, we're in trouble now, and in bad trouble economically. So somebody must have had some good crop seasons too. I think increasingly our officials in the public schools, although they're doing it sometimes very awkwardly, I think there is a real future orientation there as well. We can no longer even think that we can draw back into our shell and remain away. The transistor radio, for example, has probably brought that as much to bring the world under each other's consideration as perhaps almost anything else. I think a third kind of change in terms of this kind of analysis is man's changing relationship to nature. And I'm talking here basically about physical nature. There was a time, I guess, when there, perhaps the historian could tell us more, when we were, with all of our technology, we were going to actually conquer all the forces of nature. How ridiculous can you get? We have, however, I think, began to understand the working with nature to obtain some of those things that we as human beings want. And I'd like to illustrate in two or three regards. First, there is at North Carolina State University and other such institutions, as well as in the private sector, tremendous genetic research going on, particularly in terms of plants and animals, and particularly plants. We're doing a tremendous amount of work in breeding for drought conditions. We're doing a lot of breeding of stock, now I'm talking about plant stock, in terms of insect control, disease control. We are even learning now, and we have some time now, to take errors in nature and translate that through research to our own benefit. Let me illustrate what I'm talking about here. I was on King Ranch in Texas several years ago, and this is where the Santa Gertrudis cattle was crossbred until they got a true breed out of it. But when they got a true breed, it had a great big set of horns on here. One of the calves didn't have any horns. So they were in the process then of trying to literally breed the horns off of the Santa Gertrudis cattle. Okay, we are doing a lot under plastic. We're doing a lot with irrigation. But man is increasingly working with nature rather than trying to assault it head on. But there is also another kind of change associated with this, not associated with that one. And this is an important one, I think. Man's relationship to other men has changed and is changing very rapidly in the small community, the rural community. We have thought in years in terms of warmth, friendship, and all the other things that goes with it. Well, certainly some of that's there. But the evidence is overwhelming that these relationships are becoming increasingly impersonal. We know increasingly more people, but we only know a part of that person. We know increasing number of people, but we only know a part of the roles that they play. So we're becoming impersonal in our dealings. 15 years ago, when we moved to another part of Raleigh, out to the north end of the town, I guess we moved on a Thursday or Friday, and on Sunday morning early, I was out walking around, met a old-timer, so he said, since he'd been out there already 2 years. And we chatted about the weather and the pine trees and so on for a little bit. Before he started to leave, he said, you're a newcomer, so let me give you some advice. I said, what's that? He said, well, don't try to get too close to your neighbor. And I thought about that a minute, and I said, well, explain to him. He said, well, sometime you might have to kill your neighbor's dog. What he was telling me is to keep my distance between, and they will keep their distance between you and them. Impersonal. That shows up in all the churches I go to. The distance, the impersonality of how close a minister can get to his parishioners has changed and is still changing rather drastically. The minister doesn't know nearly as much about his parishioners than he did years ago. I'm not saying it's good, bad, or indifferent. I'm just saying that's the fact. Yes.
Is that a new development, really?
I think it has come about, speeded up. Certainly in the last 2 decades. There was a time, well, this gets into the home as well. Husbands and wives, new husbands and wives, are really not very honest with each other in many respects. They're always guarded. They're always holding back. Due to this factor of not wanting to get too close. And I'm not too sure there aren't some real consequences here. Well, let me do one or two more of these. There are some major changes in decision making and where decisions are made. As far as the losing of local autonomy. And let me use a little gadgeteering here for a moment. There's the bell. Okay. Decisions which are made at the community level, we'll call those on the horizontal dimension. Those that are made outside the community, but affects the people inside, we'll call that the horizontal or the vertical dimension. Increasingly, the decisions, major decisions, which affect the life of the people in that community are made from outside. It's a local loss of autonomy. Down in my neck, old neck of the woods, the people in Aurora had absolutely nothing in this world to do with Texas Gulf coming in. That decision was made a long ways away. Well, these are some of the changes. There are others, but let's stop here. And the last time the bell rung when I was standing up here, I was told we had still had a couple of minutes. So any comments or observations? About some of the things which I've tried to give you about 3 hours in one. Yes, sir.
When you say the relationship between a pastor and his people will tend to be much less personal, is that nationally or rurally or what?
All the data that I've seen anywhere in the United States, I don't know about internationally.
I'm from Pennsylvania, and I haven't been back there, you know, Yankee. Haven't been back there since 73. The biggest difference I've seen between being south and up there is just that one factor. Whereas people from up north are much more blunt and open, and they'll tell you, you know, like they feel straight out. And down south, I've seen that really isn't the case. It takes much longer to get to know an individual.
Well, all you're saying is, though, that they're much more impersonal in Pennsylvania than they are here.
Well, they're, they're much more open, and they'll come around, they're a lot more blunt, and...
I don't know about that. I've
At least people I've known, you know.
I think...
You know, if you try and approach people down south like you do up north, you'll strike out, man, you know. But you ask somebody how much he makes, you know, he won't talk to you for a month, you know.
I don't know that I've ever had anybody except income tax people to ask me how much I make.
Yeah, you do.
Hmm?
People up north do. What I'm saying is they talk about different things with a much, I don't know, much freer restrictions than people that sound. And my question, the reason I need to bring this up is that can we expect much more interpersonal relationships across the board regardless of where we go from here on out?
I don't think there's any question about it. I think there's impersonal, and just because there are certain areas that people will talk about just doesn't necessarily mean that they have changed to greater impersonality. They're already impersonal.
What do you attribute that?
Well, there were a great many differences that go have a long, start to say hysterical, but I mean historical basis. And I don't understand the use of Pennsylvania. Because, let's see.
That's just my home, that's all.
Well.
New York.
Well, there's a part of the post-Civil War period that involves Pennsylvania and North Carolina, which I'll talk about later if you want to. But I just don't believe that there's that much, because I have worked with students and faculty members from every part of this country, and I have not found anything except these barriers. They may say, go to hell. And somebody else say, will you please go to hell? And that this is about the only difference that I can see. Well, anyway, thanks very much for the opportunity to share these ideas with you.